Welcome to The Debate. By 2038, artificial intelligence could, inject $76 billion into New Zealand's economy.
Which is just a massive number.
Right? It's huge. But so how exactly do you capture a windfall of that magnitude if your economy is, well, too small to build the underlying AI technology yourself?
And that is the defining question for basically any nation that isn't a global superpower right now. I mean, do you build it or do you just buy access to it?
Exactly. And that tension is the bedrock of today's discourse. We are dissecting the July 2025 document, New Zealand's Strategy for Artificial Intelligence, Investing with Confidence.
Mm-hmm.
The central question we are exploring today is whether an explicit strategy of prioritizing rapid, practical AI adoption while deliberately stepping back from foundational AI development, all under a light-touch regulatory framework, is the smartest, most secure path for a small, advanced economy.
And it's a really fascinating document because it essentially forces you to choose a lane.
It really does. So, for my position, I will be arguing that a smart adopter strategy leveraging existing competitive advantages is a highly pragmatic, high-return approach for the economy.
And I will be arguing that relying so heavily on foreign tech adoption, especially when paired with light-touch regulation, risks long-term dependency, leaves vulnerable SMEs behind, and inadequately protects our cultural intellectual property.
Well, let's look straight at the economic reality that forces this strategy's hand, right? Developing foundational AI models, the massive generative engines like GPT or Gemini.
The ones that cost an absolute fortune.
Exactly. They require hundreds of millions of dollars in upfront capital. It requires global-scale data sets and server farms that consume the energy of small cities.
Yeah, it's a massive undertaking.
It is. The economics here are entirely driven by extreme network effects and economies of scale. So there is this massive structural advantage for superpowers and trillion-dollar tech firms. For a small economy to try to compete on foundational model development is, frankly, irrational.
Okay, but
let me just finish this thought. The $76 billion projection, which would be over 15% of GDP, doesn't come from building the AI. It comes from applying the AI to local strengths.
Look, I come at it from a different way. I understand the capital constraints. I really do. But conceding the foundational layer entirely means you are inherently vulnerable to the strategic, often opaque decisions of foreign monopolies.
Vulnerable how? Exactly.
Well, you become completely dependent on foreign API pricing structures, licensing agreements, and algorithmic changes that you have absolutely zero control over. You're building your house on rented land.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. That sounds ominous, sure, but let's look at how this technology actually gets deployed. I think a lot of people misunderstand the relationship between the foundation and the application.
How so?
Think about the combustion engine. We didn't need to invent the internal combustion engine to revolutionize agriculture in this country.
No, but we...
What we needed to do was build the specialized tractor chassis, right? The custom transmission, the specific tires required to navigate the unique, muddy terrain of a New Zealand dairy farm. The value is in building the tractor, not reinventing the engine.
That's a neat analogy. But an internal combustion engine doesn't change its physical properties overnight because a company in California decided to update its safety guidelines.
Well, sure, but...
Large language models do. If a foreign monopoly tweaks the weights in their foundation model to filter out what they deem quote-unquote harmful content, they might inadvertently censor or break indigenous colloquialisms or local workflows. The mechanism of that control is entirely out of our hands.
That's a theoretical risk, though.
It's a practical one. And local developers relying on that API have absolutely no recourse when it happens.
But local firms are already proving they can build massive, resilient value on top of these global AI foundations to solve highly specific problems. Look at the agri-tech sector.
Okay.
Halter integrated AI with wearable technology for livestock management and became a $1 billion unicorn. Or take Aimer Farming. They built a smartphone-based tool where a farmer takes a five-second video of a pasture and the AI estimates the pasture mass to auto-generate grazing plans.
Mm-hmm.
It saves farmers up to 4 hours of manual labor a week.
Wait, if they're out in a paddock, they likely don't have a reliable internet connection to constantly ping a massive server farm in another hemisphere. How does a pure adopter model work there?
That is exactly the point about smart application. They aren't relying on a constant umbilical cord to an API in California for every action.
So what are they doing?
They are using model compression and edge computing. The AI is running locally on the smartphone hardware to do the immediate visual analysis. They are taking the broad capability of machine learning and shrinking it down for a highly specific low connectivity environment.
I see.
They didn't need to build a multi-billion parameter foundation model to do this. The intellectual property, you know, the moat, is the proprietary Paddock digital twins and the localized data set they've cultivated, not the underlying neural network architecture.
I don't deny that AMR, farming, or halter are brilliant niche applications. They are. But let's look at the history cited in the strategy document itself. It proudly mentions the University of Waikato's 1996 Weka machine learning tool, right?
Yeah. A massive success.
Exactly. It's still referenced in tens of thousands of global research publications. But Weka wasn't born out of a strategy of passive practical adoption. It required deep foundational computer science research.
Times have changed since 1996, though.
But if a nation explicitly pivots its science and technology funding away from foundational innovation and tells its ecosystem to just focus on being smart adopters, it hollows out the capability to ever build the next Weka.
But the resources required to build Weka in 1996 are in a completely different universe than what's required to build a foundational AI model today. I mean, it's a fundamental question of resource allocation.
Right, but if we pour our limited R&D capital into training a generic foundational model, we starve the applied sciences of the funding they need to solve immediate local problems. I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. If the overarching goal is widespread practical adoption to capture that $76 billion productivity gain, we need to look at who is actually adopting it. Because right now, the strategy is failing the vast majority of the economic landscape.
Failing? How so? The document notes that 67% of large businesses are already utilizing some form of AI. That's incredibly rapid uptake.
Yes, large businesses with dedicated IT departments. But large businesses are not the entirety of the economy. If you look at the state of play data in the text, it reveals a massive capability chasm.
Okay, let's hear it.
A staggering 68% of small and medium enterprises, which are the absolute backbone of local commerce, by the way, have absolutely no plans to evaluate or invest in AI technology.
Wow.
Yeah. Let me put that in perspective. Compare that to a neighboring advanced economy like Australia, where only 38% of SMEs lack plans for adoption. We are miles behind.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because the government is fully aware of that gap. The strategy explicitly addresses it through a demystification campaign.
A campaign?
Right. They've published companion documents like the Responsible AI Guidance for Businesses. The idea is that the barrier is largely informational. If you show businesses the safe path, they will walk it.
That sounds great in a boardroom, but look at the actual data the strategy provides. Information and awareness are not the primary barriers.
What do you mean?
The data shows that 43% of non-users specifically cite a total lack of technical expertise as their main reason for not adopting AI. Think about a mid-size accounting firm listening to this right now. You can't just hand them a PDF guidance document and expect them to suddenly know how to safely integrate their clients' highly sensitive financial data into a large language model.
Well, what is stopping them exactly?
The underlying mechanics of how these systems ingest data. If that accounting firm doesn't have an in-house software engineer to properly configure an enterprise-grade API with strict data retention policies, they might just upload client tax returns into a public web interface.
Oh, yeah, that would be bad.
They are terrified of inadvertently training a public model on private data and breaching client confidentiality. That is why they are paralyzed. Demystifying the technology doesn't magically impart the engineering expertise required to deploy it securely.
You're ignoring the structural investments the government is making alongside those guidance documents, though. They are actively funding the capacity needed to bridge that exact expertise gap.
Are they?
Yes. Budget 2025 allocated $213 million for tuition and training subsidies and another $64 million specifically for STEM. They are building a massive pipeline of technical talent through programs like Victoria University of Wellington's Master of AI and the University of Auckland's Software Engineering degree.
I have to push back there. Subsidizing future university students in a Master of AI program does absolutely nothing for a 20-person manufacturing firm losing ground to a highly automated Australian competitor today.
It takes time to build a workforce.
A master's student graduating in 3 years is not going to help a local factory implement a predictive maintenance algorithm on their assembly line by next Tuesday.
It is a transition period. You have to see the long-term talent pool while managing the short-term. And for the short-term, they are funding ground-level support right now.
Such as?
Upskilling advisors at Business Mentors New Zealand and the Regional Business Partner Network, who actively reach over 5,000 businesses annually. And, crucially, the government is leading by example to prove the technology is immediately accessible. The Ministry of Business, Innovation, and Employment actually walked the talk by using AI under human supervision to ideate and draft this very strategy document.
Look, it's certainly a novel PR move that MBIE used an LLM to help write a strategy document. I'll give him that.
It shows it can be done.
But drafting a policy paper is fundamentally different from a logistics company integrating dynamic AI routing into their supply chain. And as for that long-term university pipeline you mentioned,
yeah,
the strategy itself acknowledges that the small local population intensifies competition for AI talent globally. Those highly subsidized master's students are incredibly likely to take their degrees and immediately leave for higher salaries in Silicon Valley or Sydney. The structural reality is that SMEs are largely left to fend for themselves in a highly complex technical market.
But even if a local business does successfully overcome that expertise barrier and adopts the AI, they're stepping into a complex legal environment. Which brings up what I consider one of the strongest elements of this strategy, the regulatory framework.
You mean the lack thereof?
No, the government has made a very deliberate, pragmatic choice to maintain a light-touch, principles-based environment.
Rather than drafting comprehensive AI-specific legislation.
Exactly. Because AI is evolving at a breakneck pace. If you try to draft heavy-handed, highly prescriptive AI laws today, they will be technologically obsolete in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, New Zealand has adopted the OECD AI principles, focusing on high-level values like transparency and accountability, and integrated them into existing technology-neutral laws like the Privacy Act and the Fair Trading Act.
Which sounds incredibly agile until you look at what those generic laws fail to protect.
The agility is what allows companies like QA Digital to thrive. They are an indigenous-owned media tech company. They use AI, specifically their voice queue software, to localize media into over 900 language codes for massive platforms like Netflix and Disney.
Right.
If you suddenly impose a rigid, restrictive AI compliance layer, you suffocate that exact kind of local innovation. You create a regulatory burden that only the massive global monopolies can afford to navigate, which paradoxically hurts the local adopters you're trying to protect.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the unique vulnerabilities that technology-neutral laws simply do not address?
Like what?
The most pressing ethical and economic concern highlighted in this material is Maori data sovereignty. Maturanga Maori, so traditional knowledge, cultural practices, and indigenous data, are categorized as tanga. They are cultural treasures.
And the strategy does acknowledge that Maori communities view AI with both interest and concern.
Acknowledgement isn't protection. Think about the mechanics of how global foundational models are trained. They deploy massive web crawlers that indiscriminately scrape the internet.
Right, that's how they build the data sets.
Exactly. They vacuum up indigenous cultural knowledge, stories, and language, internalize those patterns into their weights and biases, and then commercially exploit that knowledge without offering consent, control, or compensation to the originators.
It is a difficult issue, I'll admit.
Existing consumer privacy laws were designed to protect an individual's credit card number or personal health record. They were absolutely not designed to protect collective cultural heritage from automated digital extraction.
It is a profound challenge, but a light-touch regulatory approach doesn't mean doing nothing. Te Puni Kokiri, the Ministry of Maori Development, is actively exploring ways to support the appropriate use of cultural IP. The Center for Data Ethics and Innovation has already published specific guidance regarding the use of Maori data.
But relying on published guidance and a promise to actively monitor international developments in global forums is an incredibly weak shield against an immediate threat.
Why do you say that?
Litigation and norm formation at the international level take decades. Algorithmic data scraping happens in milliseconds. The 2024 submissions to the Amplify strategy explicitly highlighted these exact threats. By maintaining a light-touch approach, we are essentially leaving the back door wide open for global digital extraction.
But here's the paradox we have to wrestle with, and it's something you have to consider when demanding heavy regulation. The exact same global compute power that threatens to commodify and extract indigenous culture is the exact same machine needed to save and revitalize it.
How so?
Well, Kiwa Digital has a new application called CultureQ. It uses AI to revitalize indigenous languages at massive scale. If we heavily legislate at the national level to aggressively wall off all cultural data from global models, do we risk cutting off the interoperability and the very tools that allow organizations to do that revitalization work?
That is a false dichotomy. You can utilize compute power without freely surrendering the dataset to the model provider.
How?
By demanding clear, legally enforceable data sovereignty frameworks rather than polite guidance. If the foundational models want to operate in this jurisdiction, they must be legally compelled to respect opt-out protocols and data provenance, which generic privacy laws do not currently enforce for collective knowledge.
Let me point you to an example from the material that proves you can protect cultural IP without sweeping new national legislation. Look at Tehuku Media.
Oh, yeah.
They are a charitable organization that created an AI speech recognition model for Te Reo Māori. And, well, it boasts an astonishing 92% accuracy rate. It outperformed massive global models.
That is a phenomenal success story. But how did they achieve it without being extracted?
By building a localized moat. They didn't rely on generic web scraping. They engaged deeply with native speakers and communities to build a culturally nuanced, highly accurate data set. And crucially, they held that data set in trust.
Right.
The data isn't sitting on the open web for a crawler to grab. It is protected by the community itself. That is how you win. You win by building superior, culturally embedded applications on top of the technology, not by trying to legally blockade the technology at the border.
Tehuku is an incredible example of digital stewardship, but they are the exception that proves the rule. They had to build their own bespoke protections precisely because the national regulatory framework offers no structural defense against extraction.
But they did it.
Yes, but when the baseline strategy is rapid adoption and light touch regulation, the burden of protection is entirely offloaded onto the individual communities and businesses.
I think we've successfully mapped the core tension here, examining both the macroeconomic logic and the micro-level vulnerabilities really deepens how we understand tech policy.
Absolutely.
From my perspective, this strategy represents a highly confident, clear-eyed approach. By embracing practical adoption, removing regulatory friction, and backing it with $1.2 billion in annual science, innovation, and technology funding, the government is setting the stage for massive economic growth.
And they are certainly leveraging international partnerships to try and accelerate that.
Precisely. They aren't doing it in isolation. Look at the $12 million Singapore-New Zealand AI for Healthy Aging Initiative, which targets shared challenges like neurological conditions. This is how a small economy competes. We capture that $76 billion opportunity by being the smartest applicator of the technology, without pretending we have the endless resources of a global superpower.
While I completely acknowledge the brilliance of these localized applications in healthcare, agriculture, and media, my position remains that an adoption-centric strategy carries heavy, unmitigated structural risks. The brilliant niches do not offset the massive capability chasm.
Right.
By prioritizing rapid uptake and maintaining light-touch regulation, we are leaving the vast majority of our SMEs stranded without the technical expertise to compete. Simultaneously, we are leaving irreplaceable cultural intellectual property unacceptably vulnerable to global extraction. It is a classic case of trading long-term sovereignty for short-term efficiency.
Which brings us right back to our opening thought. There are facets of this economic transition we didn't even have time to fully unpack today.
Absolutely. Listeners who really want to understand the economic engine behind this, should look into the source material section on the Strategic Reforms to the Overseas Investment Act, or the new Active Investor Plus visa. They are specifically designed to attract foreign direct investment into this very ecosystem to fund this adoption.
We will leave it to the listener to weigh the evidence and determine which path secures the most robust future. But it always comes back to the grid. We know the infrastructure is being built, the power is surging globally. The ultimate question is whether simply plugging our existing machinery into that grid is enough to eliminate the future, or if true security requires owning at least a little bit of the current.
Until next time.